My name is Fred Nagel, and thank you for joining us today for Children in Detention, an Introduction to No Way to Treat a Child campaign. And thank you to our two panelists, Kwame Holmes, PhD scholar in residence, Human Rights Program, Bard College, and Shayna Lowe, U.S. Advocacy Officer at the Defense for Children International, Palestine. Thanks to the four groups who sponsored this event, that's Jewish Voice for Peace, Hudson Valley, Middle East Crisis Response, Veterans for Peace, Women in Black, New Pulse. And thanks to the other groups that have come together to tell their members about this event and to support us in other ways. So thank you. A little history. We came up with the idea of the meeting our local House Representative Antonio Delgado about what we thought was systemic mistreatment, abuse, arrest of Palestinian youths. And we scheduled a time with him several months in advance. In our preparation for the meeting, we started a petition urging him to become a co-sponsor of House Resolution 2407, that ended U.S. military sales to countries that abuse children. We also attended some of his local town meetings. We were lucky enough to be called on. Several of us asked questions, and they were about Palestinian rights and the treatment of Palestinian children by Israeli police. Many of us have actually voted for him in the election, and we're hoping that he would actually come out with a progressive stance on Palestinian human rights. But his town hall answers were not that encouraging. In fact, I asked a question about Palestinian children, and he did nothing but talk about Israel's right to defend itself. And at the end of maybe 10 or 15 minutes, I couldn't remember one time when he even mentioned the Palestinians. Moreover, after these meetings, I don't think it had anything to do with our questions, but Representative Delgado canceled our meeting and said if we wanted to talk to him, it would be through his aide instead. So we decided to make a campaign out of his refusals. We thought he was running away from this issue. Our online petition had reached 2,000 signatures, very close to 2,000, and we asked all our signers to call his D.C. office about H.R. 2407 and urge him to become a sponsor. We also videotaped the statements we were planning to make to him, and we put that online for everybody to see, the 2,000 people. In our campaign to get Representative Delgado to sponsor this legislation that protected children, we came to the realization that we ourselves live in a society that does very similar things to people of color, especially children and young adults. I've worked in public schools most of my career. My one example, I think, was reading about how many police are in the New York City public schools, thousands, and how many arrests and summonses they give. Hundreds and hundreds of arrests are made within that New York City public schools, and 90% of the arrests are black students. And, you know, since I've worked so much in education, I contrast this to the white schools up and down the Hudson Valley. How many white students have been arrested at school? I have only, to my knowledge, only one in a school I worked for was arrested, in fact, in school. So, in fact, this panel is sort of the result of our acknowledgement that racist mistreatment of youth is rampant in both Israel and the United States. And there are connections between them, you know, from the training of police forces to the apartheid nature of both societies. And our hope is that we will come to learn how to really combat racism by understanding these common threads. So we have a little housekeeping. Let me review just briefly what's going to come up. After the panelists have made their initial presentations, Margie Leopold will ask some pre-written questions of the panel. Then Felice Gelman will ask some written questions from your chat list. So if you're interested, down at the bottom there is a chat list. Type your question questions in there, and we'll try to get to a lot of the questions before the end. So that's what we're hoping that this is going to be like. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. I think we're going to have an interesting and a truly rewarding panel from this. So let's go to our first panelist, Kwame Holmes. Would you join us?
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for, sorry, this is my opening statement, yes?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this event. I'm going to echo Fred's acknowledgement of Women in Black, Mideast Crisis, Veterans for Peace, and Jewish Voice for Peace. And I am especially excited to be a part of this because of the real moment of possibility that I think we all are finding ourselves in, unexpected possibility around opposing abusive policing practices and mass incarceration, and thinking about what could be the alternatives for a different type of future. Though I think in order to do that effectively, we have to also look backwards. And I'm a historian by training, and particularly I'm a historian of modern America. And what I've been most interested in is trying to understand what we got right about the civil rights moment, the liberationist movements of the 1960s and 70s, and also how that moment made this one possible, created a set of political trends and cultural hegemonies, you could say, that have made it possible for the police to engage in such intense mistreatment of juveniles, and particularly of African American minors. So I just wanted to very quickly talk about my broad research project, which is not in and of itself entirely concerned with juvenile justice, but which has some implications for its application. Again, as I mentioned, I'm interested in an understanding the implications, the long implications of the civil rights era. And one thing that I argue in my work is that the civil rights era helps us to understand a huge part of the culture of neoliberalism. And I know that this is a word that is used exhaustingly and can be exhausting to hear over and over again, but I just want to talk very briefly about what it means for me. Neoliberalism being that move towards the marketization, the privatization of public services, right, as a kind of form of governance, but also a cultural move wherein the logics of the market come to be understood as the only acceptable premises for governance, and where market rationality and an emotional rationality in general become the only means to create legitimate political discourse. So what we see emerging out of the civil rights era is the ascendance of African-American, white, gay, and lesbian, feminist movements, which are able to achieve all sorts of new access to education, white collar jobs, positions in government, provided that they operate within a certain emotional bandwidth, a kind of non-strident, rational, comportment and set of political demands. And the reason why I've raised that issue is because, and I think why it's so relevant to this topic, is because the moves that are made that I look at in my work that have produced such disparate outcomes in the application of juvenile justice since World War II were, yes, in part predicated on sort of wild racial stereotypes like the super predator, right, which we saw Hillary Clinton's use of that term quoted at ad nauseum in 2016, but were also made through very quiet bureaucratic administrative processes that were quite invisible to the eye, and which all often had to do with how racial minorities were categorized psychologically and emotionally in different ways than white children. And so that sort of interest in the emotional realm as a means of understanding politics and as sort of locating those policies which otherwise are kind of hidden from view is a huge part of my research agenda and what I think I'd like to share during more about during the Q&A. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Kwame. And Shayna, your opening remarks, please, would be great.
Great, thank you. So I echo Kwame's thanks for all the sponsoring groups and for bringing together this group of, what are we at, 49 participants right now. So it's really a pleasure to be virtually with you. I wish I could be upstate in the Hudson Valley and not in Brooklyn, but this is the best we can do for now. So as Fred mentioned in his opening remarks, I work for an organization called Defense for Children International Palestine. We're a local Palestinian human rights organization. I am one of a handful of staff that are located in the US and the UK who support our Palestinian team on the ground in international advocacy efforts. And we've been instrumental in helping Representative McCollum introduce both the previous legislation she had in the past Congress, HR 4391, and this current piece of legislation, which the folks up in the Hudson Valley have been advocating around, HR 2407. So I just want to briefly give you a window into kind of what is going on the ground with Palestinian children in detention and give you kind of an understanding of the legal framework that we're operating in. So since Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, there really have been two sets of laws that have been operating at the same time in that territory. There's Israeli civilian law, which applies to Israeli Jewish settlers who are illegally living in the West Bank. And there's military law, which has been imposed on the Palestinians living in the West Bank since almost, we're right at the 53 anniversary just a few days ago with the Six-Day War. What this means is that And just to kind of frame it in terms of thinking about the conversations that are happening in the US right now, those of us that are angry and frustrated about police practices, we're realizing that these decisions are made at a very local level. And so there are efforts being made to put pressure on local leadership to change the laws and change the way that they're applied in order to have more equity. This is not the case in Palestine. In occupied Palestine, a military general writes the laws and that's it. Children who are arrested in the West Bank are automatically tried in military courts. Military courts are not meant for civilians, let alone civilian children. These are courts where children are deprived of basic due process rights. The child's experience in detention begins at the moment of arrest. In our documentation, and I should have mentioned, we've been representing Palestinian children since 1991, and my boss in Ramallah just told us that we estimate that we've provided legal assistance and legal aid to around 5,000 Palestinian children in those in just under 30 years. So for most children, their arrest begins actually at night. Two-thirds of the children we documented last year were arrested in night raids on their homes. So I just watched a Vice News special about Breonna Taylor and saw a video of an execution of a no-knock warrant, and was struck by the similarities in the tactics and the just like devastating impact that it has on a family. That's the moment where a child realizes that their home is not safe and their parents can't do anything to protect them. Children are then bound and blindfolded. Over 95% of children experience this. Their hands are tied behind their backs with a zip ties. And then they're taken frequently to a number of stops, Israeli settlements, before they end up at an interrogation center. They have no right to access to counsel when they're being interrogated, no right to have access to their parents when they're being interrogated. Even in the rare cases where children are issued summonses to show up at a military base or an interrogation center, their parents are turned away at the door and the children are brought in. Trials are held in military courts by overseen by judges who impartial. And what we see is widespread ill treatment and even torture of these children, ranging from physical abuse. About 3/4 of the children report some type of physical abuse, either after they've been arrested or during interrogation, psychological abuse, the use of coercions and threats. And most of these children are charged with minor offenses like stone throwing. And they can be arrested not necessarily for having, you know, thrown a stone at a specific time in a specific act, but just on the suspicion that a child may have thrown stones at some point. What we see is, and what we learned through our research when we started representing these children almost 30 years ago, is that we started hearing that we're hearing the same stories over and over and over again about ill treatment, children put in stress positions, children put in solitary confinement where they have no idea what time of day it is, where they're given horrible food to eat and not given proper medical care. And so that's really what led to us evolving from a legal aid organization to doing documentation of these abuses to demonstrate how systematic and widespread and institutionalized they are. I think we're seeing here in the United States, people are finally waking up and realizing that police brutality is not an isolated incident. It's not a bad apple on a police force. It's a culture of impunity that allows law enforcement to abuse their power with as we saw in the case of George Floyd, where I just read today about the numerous calls to 911, calling the police on the police. There's just no, there's very little means for people to agitate and make change without getting broader support. And that's why we work on the bill in Congress, we engage with UN actors, and we do other things to put pressure on Israeli authorities to end these systematic abuses. So I think I'll end it there and can expand more in the questions. Thank you.
Great. Can everybody hear? Put a note in the chat if you can't hear. We want to make sure everybody can hear, and I'm very sorry if you can't. 5 new messages. Okay, they're not about not being able to hear. Okay, great. Thank you, Shana. So I have some questions for both Kwame and Shana. I'm going to ask them, and then if your questions come in, please put them in the chat, and after these questions for our two speakers, I have 3 for each of them, then Felice will pose your questions to Kwame and Shana, and at the end we'll have some open discussion. So let's get started. The first question is, Kwame, the history of racism in the United States as a response to juvenile poverty.
I am now unmuted again. Thanks for that question. I think it's a really important one. As I referenced earlier, the history of sort of racially disparate responses to juvenile poverty and to juvenile delinquency, antisocial behavior, whatever you would call it, is one that still needs to be more understood. And I want to draw everyone's attention to the mid-20th century as a key origin point for this division and how the state responds to juvenile delinquency. Many people, I'm sure, are familiar with the term white flight, a phenomenon that describes white Anglo and second generation European migration out of inner cities and into newly developed federal suburbs. And people are familiar with redlining. This has become more part of our mainstream knowledge in the last decade or so. But one thing that we do pay less attention to is how white flight created divergent and racialized approaches to juvenile antisocial behavior. And I'm just going to give an example from the Washington DC metro area, which is where I've done a lot of my research. So in the DC metro area, which includes the nation's capital and also the inner ring suburbs, Silver Spring, Greenbelt, Alexandria, Virginia, et cetera, there was a lot of studies which conducted in the early 1970s, which revealed that as white flight was occurring in the 50s and 1960s, that there was two sort of geographically distinct responses to antisocial behavior. The majority of inner city children who were arrested in the 50s and 60s were removed from their homes, sent to what we used to call training schools, right, essentially juvenile justice prisons, or they were sent to foster parents outside of the District of Columbia, which severed the relationship between parent and child. And by contrast, the majority of antisocial children in the suburbs were categorized as emotionally disturbed rather than as delinquents. And they were sent to inpatient mental health facilities as close to home as possible, preserving the connection between parents and children. So you can imagine the implications of this. You have one set of kids, there's a treatment approach and a goal to return home. And you have another set of kids where there's punishment and isolation as the response to antisocial behavior. And one of the things that's really important about describing this as a sort of function of white flight and suburbanization is that the pathway a child took through the system was determined by the state's assessment of their home life, the home they would return to, right? And so redlining ensured that more numbers of Black families were renters, living in crowded apartment buildings, often real slums, were in a constant warfare against rats and other vermin. And often their landlords would be residents of the suburbs. in fact, in my work, I talk about this one Greek family who ran a kind of slum lord ring in DC and also a crime syndicate that distributed heroin and sex workers in the inner city. And so their activities get framed as suburban, right? And the conditions that they create within the inner city become the rationale for the state separation of parent and child at the point of antisocial behavior. And that gets totally invisibilized, right? That relationship between the landlord and the environment, that gets ignored in how the state assesses how to treat antisocial behavior in children. So I saw Jane put in the chat, is there different laws for Black and white kids? It's not so much laws, but divergent administrative policies that were determined by how the state decided what kind of families could actually care for delinquent kids and which families couldn't be responsible enough to do so. And that's continued basically to the present day.
So thank you, that's great. I'm just trying to help somebody who's muted. But sorry, everybody. Well, Shana, I want to ask you the same question, only framed in a slightly different way than Kwame's was. Your question is the history. Share with us something about the history of Palestinian arrests and incarceration as a response to the Palestinian resistance to the occupation. And Shana.
Sorry, I was muted.
There you are. Okay, you're unmuted.
I'm unmuted now. Yeah, that's a great question. So I think Palestinian children are frequently arrested from places where there is resistance to the occupation, sometimes violent resistance and oftentimes nonviolent resistance. And we frequently see that children are arrested where there's friction points between Israeli military or settlement or occupation infrastructure and Palestinian communities. So that's, you know, Palestinian villages and towns that are near Israeli settlements, near the wall or checkpoints, maybe near military bases or in a closed military zone. And so frequently what we see in terms of the arrests, it's not necessarily about the child themselves having committed a crime, but it's about using juvenile detention as a means of controlling entire communities. These arrests have really widespread implications on the family. Like I mentioned earlier, if 2/3 of the children are being arrested at night from their homes, there's likely other children present in those homes too, who not only experience the trauma of an invading army, but also the trauma of losing a sibling. You have parents who feel completely helpless because they're unable to protect their children. And so what we see is that it's not even necessarily that people are resisting in violent means, but that it's in Nabi Saleh, for example, or Beline, when they had very active weekly protests, there were scores of children being arrested, and they were using those arrests on the pretext of maybe saying, accusing a child of throwing a stone, to also gather intelligence about the community, find out who is organizing the marches or the protests, who is agitating people and getting people to want to rise up, because they realize that if they quash that, then they quash it all. For Palestinian children and who are detained, obviously it disrupts their schooling as well. We just had a case, I don't think we've published yet on our website, but it's in the works, the news alert. Three children were arrested in the midst of their final exams in night raids on their homes. These are exams that are necessary for, you know, graduating from high school, getting into college, and finding out what course of study you're going to take. And if you fail any day of the tests, you fail the entire thing and you have to start over. So two of the boys who were arrested within the last 2 weeks were released today without ever being charged with anything. And so it doesn't matter even if they're resisting or not. In many ways, it's about using detention as a means of control, preventing Palestinians from reaching their full potential, and creating a generation of young, predominantly boys, because girls are very rarely arrested, but boys who return to society unable but they require a lot of rehabilitation and support in order to reintegrate into society. It's very difficult to return to school. They get behind in their schooling, and then they come back and they're like, why should I be with a bunch of kids younger than me when I'm like a man and have been through prison? And so it's really creating generations of and generational trauma that impacts more than just the 500 to 700 boys who are arrested each year.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Shayna. All right, question two, Kwame. This is the one where I want you to speak for a moment about how the American police and prosecutors justify arresting and prosecuting a disproportionate number of Black and Brown youths, mostly for minor offenses.
It's an interesting question. And also just everyone, the sun is setting. And so my lighting is now, I feel like I'm suddenly in a remake of Serpico. I apologize. But I will nonetheless persevere. It's a super interesting question. And it's a funny one because, you know, when it comes to juvenile justice, the question of justification is different than in other areas of criminal law. Like when you think about how the state responds when it sees an adult that it thinks is involved in a criminal activity, a police officer, for example, you know, sees an adult they think is selling drugs or has some reasonable suspicion of a criminal act, then the law sort of compels a set of procedures like arrest, apprehend, book, set some sort of bail. Maybe there's a mandatory minimum sentence. And so prosecutors and law enforcement and judges can all claim a kind of plausible deniability, like, you know, oh, it's just the law, it compels how the process works. In the case of juvenile justice, there's so much more discretion. So like, for example, only 19 states have a law which explicitly says you can have cash bail in the case of a juvenile criminal case. 9 states outlaw cash bail, and 28 states have no language which either prohibits or allows cash bail. So there's enormous discretion. Can prosecutors, like, will they charge as an adult? Will they charge as a minor? Like, will the officer just bring the child home, right? This also speaks to the kind of relationships that they might have with the community. Will they bring them home? Will they arrest them? So because there's so much more discretion in the administration of juvenile justice than in the adult criminal system, it really does actually speak to how the human heart, right, plays out in these decisions. And there's a lot of really interesting work within cultural studies. I strongly recommend a Harvard professor's by the name of Robin Bernstein's book called Racial Innocence. And she goes all the way back to the 19th century. And she talks about how part of this kind of cultural regime of slavery was to imagine the Black child, the enslaved child, as not being able to feel pain. And there's all kinds of cultural products and all kind of messages which reinforce that notion. And one could imagine that when an officer decides to take a Black child to detention rather than to bring them home if they see them engaged in a criminal act, that on some level they are disregarding the fact that, as Shana points out, this is a super traumatic experience and that it will be scarring, right? They are able to kind of say that the pain the child will experience is somehow not legible or important, and it can be, and that society's interests outweigh that pain. And this is also where the question of slavery becomes important, because of course, you know, slavery was a capitalist system, and the kinds of criminalizing policies like stop and frisk or the intense regulation of subway turnstiles in New York City, the light departs with every moment. Those are about, they're basically like stop loss policies, right? I mean, stop and frisk is about ensuring that neighborhoods don't experience a kind of small time crime, broken windows, vandalism that investors believe drive away potential commercial markets and consumers, the same suburban consumers who had left the city in the 1950s. And so those kinds of practices are designed to maximize the profit of land investors in the city, in the same way that the abuse of an enslaved child in the 19th century was about maximizing the land investors who had planted cotton. I think that there's so much overlap between those eras. And so, that's what I think we can say in terms of the explanation. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. As you're speaking, Kwame, I don't know how many other people are re-seeing scenes from 13th, which is now available on Netflix. And, you know, your descriptions are so vividly portrayed in that film of young men and the way they're being characterized, especially that they don't feel pain in the same way. It just, you know, it's such a chilling thought. So the question for you, Shana, again, similar but slightly reframed, is how do Israeli soldiers and prosecutors justify arresting and prosecuting Palestinian youth for crimes such as rock throwing or protesting the occupation? It's the question of justification. How do they do that?
Yeah, well, it's very easy for them to do because they can write, you know, a military general has the authority to write the laws. And so they have the ability to write these laws. As I mentioned, they don't need to have, to arrest a child, they don't need to have specific charges. And so it's frequently kind of based on these loose allegations, you know, you threw stones. We know you threw stones. The child says, no, I didn't. And after a number of hours, you know, when a child is in interrogation, being interrogated by somebody, often probably speaking to them with a funny accent because it's an Israeli speaking in Arabic to them, the child's instinct eventually is to confess regardless of whether or not they've done it, because they just want to get out of that situation, particularly in cases where the child is put in stress positions, tied to low chairs and all of that. So in terms of the justification legally, it's really through the military law that they basically can do what they want and don't need to respect children's due process rights because they don't have any. The other thing that's significant, which I mentioned briefly, is that the judges in these military courts are members of the military. They're dependent on their superiors for promotion. And so, you know, in a typical, in the American judicial system, we don't think of the prosecutor and the judge being on the same side. The judge is supposed to be an impartial figure who's meant to maintain order and allow both sides to plead their case. And in this case, we don't have that. I want to also mention about the conviction rates in the military courts, which are about 99%. And most children that we represent, and this is where I think we're put in a really difficult position as children's advocates, we are guided by, and part of our global movement of defense for children that we're a part of, is to be guided by the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And Israel is a signatory to that convention. The International Court of Justice, in their opinion on the wall, reaffirmed what human rights advocates had been saying for a long time, that Israel's obligations under their human rights treaties not only apply inside of the Green Line, but also to the land that Israel occupies. The human rights side of us, there are two things that we consider. One is the best interests of the child must always be taken into consideration, and two, and should be primary, and two, detention should be a last resort. And what we found in these military courts is that the administrative process of taking a child through, you know, all the way through a trial is longer than if the child takes a plea deal. And so many of you might be aware of the Khalif Browder case, he was a child who was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack, which he didn't steal. And he refused to take a plea deal, and he spent years in prison, and finally a judge released him. And that's kind of the similar situation that our children that we represent would be in. If they didn't plead guilty to, you know, throwing one stone, they would end up even if they took it to trial and were found innocent, they might end up spending more time in an Israeli prison than if we just encourage them to take a plea deal. And so it's a really hard position for us, because we our hands are tied, and in some ways we almost have to become complicit in this horrible system in order to protect the children who are currently in prison, but but aren't able to do enough to
prevent
those detentions from happening to children in the future. And so it doesn't really matter whether or not a child has committed a crime. If the Israelis decide that they want to target that child and put them in prison, they'll succeed.
Mm. Okay. So many similarities here, we're hearing. And the final question is, what is commonly experienced during juvenile incarceration, and what are the outcomes of this experience? And then, of course, what are the alternatives to juvenile incarceration? And that opens us up to this very moment, I think. And this question first to you, Kwame.
Thank you again. And yeah, that was so moving, Shana. Thank you for your work. Yeah, I mean, on a certain level, I really want to pivot to the question of alternatives. I do feel that everyone here sort of knows what happens. And I think the fact, for example, the citation, Marjorie, of 13th does speak again to the ways in which, thank goodness, there's been a real circulation, a popular circulation of the critiques of mass incarceration and the types of experiences that people have in them and the long-term effects that those can have. I'm the thing that I'm most moved by at the moment is the realm of alternatives. And I just want to talk with people very briefly about a project that I'm helping to organize within Kingston, New York's Mutual Aid project, which is, we're calling Neighborhood Pods. Well, what is a neighborhood pod? A neighborhood pod is a set of neighbors and particularly who've made the decision to trust each other, who've made a decision to be able to be vulnerable enough to each other to say, here's what I might need. Maybe I'm short on food. Maybe I'm short on rent money. Maybe I don't have clothes for my kid, or maybe I have an abundance of these things and I'm really eager to meet the needs of the people within my neighborhood. And that kind of horizontal distribution of services isn't just about the question of immediate needs. It's also about questions of safety. And the decision that people would make in a neighborhood pod would be to look to each other to help to guarantee safety before reaching out to the police. Because I think that one of the most difficult parts of the attempt to abolish the police is not the question of like, well, if the money leaves the police department, which programs will it go to? Or the question of political will is not like what will happen with the murderers or what have you. I think what's really difficult about being able to even contemplate the idea of abolishing the police is that to do so would mean we would have to step up and kind of grow up, right? And stop allowing the parental figure, whether lionized or resented, we're still attached to it, the parental figure of the police to handle conflict between ourselves and the people in our community. It would mean that even if sports were to come back, it maybe, instead of watching the game, we would have to go to our neighborhood pod meeting or to a local town hall where we adjudicated conflict between each other rather than relying upon the state. Because all the things which the state does, no matter what our political identification, the state does in our name, whether we authorize it by voting for conservatives or whether we kind of passively allow it by voting for so-called liberals. There's nothing that happens that we don't allow. And so the neighborhood pod structure is about, on a very small scale, starting to step up to each other, replacing dependence upon the state in as many arenas as possible, including on the question of safety, and replacing it with trust and mutuality, and replacing it with risk. You know, the very same policies which say, arrest that kid who's vandalizing the building and charge him with a crime that could send him down the path towards a significant time in prison. Those are about risk management. That the, again, because land investors have taken a risk on investment and they want to ensure that they will yield a profit. And on so many areas of life, we've allowed the question of risk to take over our thinking about what we'll do. And so I think we have to be willing to risk that there might be a robbery and that the response could be, let's just pool our resources to replace that item instead of calling the police. So that's what I would love to talk about more. as much as anyone would like to. I'm happy to post a link. If you live in Kingston, we're doing our first training for pod leaders next Monday. I'll post the link to the website and we can fill that out. But yeah, I think now is the time for us to grow up and to govern ourselves. And we can complain about the mean parent of the state, or we can do something about it.
I'm just bursting with excitement and feeling about that, Kwame. It's like all of my favorite books, including Woman on the Edge of Time, if anybody here has ever read it. It's very exciting. Shaina, I'm going to ask you, a very similar question. The outcomes of Palestinian juvenile incarceration, we know our trauma, horrible. So why don't we just sort of move to the opposition to this pattern, to Israeli apartheid, and how do you see the opposition growing? I think okay, you have to do it again.
Yeah, there we go. I think I'm okay. Good. Sorry about that. I muted myself while listening to Kwame and forgot all about unmuting myself. Super interesting about this, the pods. I want to learn more about this, Kwame. So hopefully there will be some questions about it. In terms of, unfortunately, I don't feel like my answer is as optimistic as Kwame's is in terms of having this moment and being able to really, if we can step up to it, make real changes. I think the situation in Palestine is much more difficult, in part because we aren't Israeli, we aren't Palestinian, and we're trying to affect change from afar. But there are things that we can do here in the U.S., to resist this and say that we don't think that this behavior is acceptable, we don't think this treatment is acceptable, and we don't want to be complicit in it. So most of you probably know, or may know, that each year we, as taxpayers, give $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel. And HR 2407, the piece of legislation that Fred spoke about in his introduction, is really it's the second bill addressing Palestinian children's rights in Congress. And this bill really gives an opportunity to send a message to the Israeli government that this practice isn't acceptable and won't be tolerated. And so, first, I'll talk a little bit about kind of the architecture of the bill to understand what it actually is calling for. And then I'll talk a little bit about like how we're using this bill in different ways to continue to raise awareness and build support. So 2407 has really two operational parts. The first is an amendment to the Leahy Law, which is a law that basically says that U.S. Assistance cannot go to countries that that commit gross violations of human rights. What this amendment to the Leahy Law does is it basically lists a whole bunch of practices, arrest and detention of children, ill treatment, torture, and it would prohibit, if passed, the distribution of any U.S. funds to any military units who are responsible for engaging in any of these prohibited practices. So it would not just apply to Israeli forces, though obviously that's the main goal, and Israel is the only country in the world that automatically and systematically prosecutes children in military courts, but it would apply to other countries that are doing similar, that are receiving U.S. aid and receiving similar support. One kind of particular about the bill that I think there's sometimes is confusion about is it doesn't mean that the $3.8 billion would not go to Israel. But what it would say, for example, is if, you know, the Golani Brigade is the ones are the ones responsible for arrest and detention of children, they wouldn't be entitled to any of the materials that the U.S. provides, financial or otherwise. And so the second part of the bill is an authorization for the allocation of funds. It's not actually an allocation of funds. That would be a second bill, but it's the first step in getting money appropriated. And that is for $19 million, which would go to human rights organizations that are monitoring and documenting Palestinian child detention, and also organizations that are providing psychosocial and rehabilitative support to help reintegrate children who have been released from Israeli prisons. The key point with the $19 million, for those of you who are doing advocacy with either Antonio Delgado or reps if you're living in other districts, is that that's really the opportunity when you talk about that $19 million to talk about the human impact on children and on their families and what the arrest experience and detention experience does for them. As of now, we have 24 co-sponsors of 2407. It's about 6 months before the term is over, so we do not think that this bill will pass. But the bill is really an opportunity, it's a vehicle for activists like you to be able to go and sit with a member of Congress, and instead of just saying, I'm concerned about Palestine, or I'm concerned about Palestinian rights, to really present a piece of legislation to focus the conversation around and to broaden the conversation that's happening in Congress. I just read today an article that was published, I think yesterday, in Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, about Jamal Bowman, who is challenging Elliot Engel in the Bronx and Westchester. And one of the things that they mentioned in that is that Bowman has come out and been critical of Israel's support for, American support for military support for Israel. And he has committed to signing on to the next piece of legislation that Representative McCollum introduces. And so what we're seeing is that Palestine used to be something that no member of Congress would want to touch. And through this legislation, we're finding opportunities to connect ordinary citizens who care about these issues with their politicians and have a concrete ask to really challenge them on. Instead of saying, why are you, you know, just signing your name on the line for every piece of legislation that supports Israel, we can say, why aren't you signing on to a bill that seeks to protect children around the world, not only Palestinian children, but children everywhere? And so these are the opportunities that I see. I do, even though I'm not optimistic about the Israeli government changing its practices right now, I am optimistic about the movement for justice for Palestinians growing in the US and the moments that we have, how unfortunate that they are, that we're in this moment where we're looking at how messed up the US injustice system is in comparison to, you know, a military occupation system. But I think drawing these parallels and being able to see the same threads of discriminatory policies and using policing and prisons to keep oppressed populations subjugated and oppressed. I think that that's a really important opportunity too. And I do have hope that our movement is growing. So I'll end with that. Thanks.
Good. Thank you, Shaina. So there's a couple of hands raised, and what we're doing now with our program is Felice is going to ask the questions that have come up on the chat to our two panelists, and we'll get to the hands raised as well. It's now It's now 8:01, so we're going to be going on for a bit longer, but I think we'll be finished probably by about 8:30, if that feels okay to everybody. Okay. All right. Thank you. Felice, do you want to unmute yourself?
Sure. Thank you for the reminder. But we have some really good questions. And I think that I'd like to start with a question which came up really sort of towards the beginning of the discussion. And Shana talked about the fact that there are two sets of laws in Israel-Palestine, one for Israelis and one for Palestinians. Kwame, would you say that it is somewhat effectively the same in the United States, or would you say that it's a different situation?
Oh, I'm unmuted. I would say that there are some really important overlaps. Again, the question of like one set of laws versus another set of laws, I mean, I think the statutes, of course, don't make any reference to racial distinction, but I think what's true is that the imagining of African-American youth as somehow an external threat, a foreign threat, which is, I think, animated by discourse like a war on crime, a war on drugs, and the fact that, as people have pointed out, there are decades-long collaborations and trainings between not only Israel and the United States in terms of policing practices, but also the former apartheid regime of South Africa, which also constructed Zulu and Xhosa and other ethnic groups as a foreign other. Like that, I think there are incredible overlaps there as well. You know, the formal structure of a military tribunal is one that we don't see, but we do see people being pressured into plea agreements without proper representation, and the use of violence by officers and guards, again, the Khalif Browder case is a great example, to compel confessions to criminal acts. And so, there's a lot of overlap in terms of technique and process and the way those acts are culturally legitimized.
Mm. Well, thanks. I think that's a very good way to be thinking about it.